Сегодня в Москве открылся учредительный съезд
Общероссийский народный фронт сегодня изменил статус
Общероссийского народного фронта съехались в столицу.
One front gathered in Moscow's ornate Manej exhibition hall just across from the Kremlin. In a tightly choreographed affair, they chanted Russia, Russia, and Putin, Putin. And another front took to the streets, marching through the center of the capital to Bolotnaya Square, the now iconic site of anti-Kremlin protests. They chanted Russia without Putin, and Putin is a thief. But while both supporters and opponents of President Vladimir Putin mobilized their forces on the Russia Day national holiday this week, neither appeared particularly convincing. The Putin supporters who gathered to rechristen the Kremlin-backed All-Russia Popular Front had the full weight of the state behind them. But with its populist appeals, patriotic rhetoric, and retro-Soviet vibe, the front's founding Congress reeked of yet another stage-managed attempt for the regime to re-legitimize itself to an increasingly skeptical public. They have all the power, but they seem to know that time is not on their side. The opposition protest was festive, went off peacefully, and was attended by approximately 10,000 people. But after 18 months of protest, the opposition has little to show for its efforts. Dozens of activists remain in prison, political reform is nowhere on the horizon, and a crackdown against dissent is in full swing. The Russian street may believe that it owns the future, but it can't escape the fact that it's losing the present. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services, author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark. Congratulations on your wedding, which I understand took place on the exact same day that Vladimir Putin announced his divorce.
Well, yes, thanks very much, Brian. I would hesitate to say there was a connection.
Okay, well, we'll explore whether or not there was at some point, I'm sure. And on the Skype line from London, fresh from a trip to Russia, is Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Welcome back, Kirill.
Thank you. Fresh is a too strong word for me now.
Fresh. Yeah. And joining us also via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Welcome, Sean.
Hello, guys.
Mark, let's start it off with you. As I watched the Popular Front's Congress and the opposition demo yesterday, I had this weird feeling of deja vu and an odd feeling of symmetry. Both camps seem to be trying to re-legitimize themselves in the eyes of the public in spectacles that we seem to be seeing time and time again. Did you get the same impression?
Yeah, very much so. But I think, as ever with politics, it's the context that is all important, and I think the contexts are very different. If you look at the opposition, in many ways, yeah, it was just your standard rally. They managed to pull out perhaps 10,000 people on the streets. They had the right posters and such like. However, considering the kind of pressure that they've been under, and considering the fact that, to be honest, they haven't got their act together, really the best they can hope to do is survive, is keep themselves there, keep themselves moderately coherent, moderately viable, for the point at which the regime messes up, so that they are in a position to benefit from it. So in many ways, I think, given that we've seen time and again, you never know, perhaps the mayoral elections, which we'll be covering later, will provide this. But you know, time and again, we've thought, oh, well, this could be the point at which the opposition manages to catalyze and reach out, and they fail to do so. So at the moment, just simply staying on life support is a success.
And another thing I noticed, it was very festive, and it was the first one that was festive in a while since the very early protests, because after, for a while, they started to take on this pro forma feel, but there was a festive feeling there. It was, to me, separate, and there was no violence, with the exception of a few left front activists getting arrested for apparently carrying illegal flags, if I understand correctly.
Bearing offensive banners. I mean, yes, you're right. And okay, in part, that's a seasonal factor as well in an environment. But I think it's also that sense that, ironically enough, Navalny's trial actually has helped the opposition. It has given them a certain level of focus that they have lacked, really, ever since they set up their coordinating committee. And obviously, the given that the regime had in a way telegraphed that it wasn't going to come down heavily on this. No one wanted to have the juxtaposition of, certainly in world TV cameras, of Putin being elevated and the truncheons rising and falling over the protesters. So in that respect, I think the regime feels it's fairly comfortable. 10,000 people on the streets for one day, that's no big deal. So I think the opposition is doing the best it can, really. The interesting thing for me is very much the popular front, and even just the language is fascinating.
Well, the language was fascinating. I was going to talk about that. It's now the All Russia Popular Front for Russia.
For Russia, exactly, yes. Just in case like there was any ambiguity.
The
Quite, who needs Judea? And in that respect, I think that it's fascinating that it represents what I've sort of talked about elsewhere. It's about this sort of horrible mouthful, the institutionalization of deinstitutionalization. In other words, Putin doesn't want a party because parties have to have platforms and policies and programs and also carry with it a sense of hierarchy and succession. Instead, he's looking for, his ideal is this kind of broad-based movement that everyone can join as long as they're good Russian patriots. And in that respect, and big caveats coming up, I'm not saying that Putin is a fascist. However, it is reminiscent of the Italian-style fascism, that notion that you can be a pensioner, you can be a soldier, you can be a factory worker, but as long as you're a good patriot, you can get behind the cause.
Or Central American corporatist regimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of these. But the point is, those only work really in certain specific circumstances. Fascism / corporatism, it needs some kind of cause. And on the whole, precisely, they tend to be backed with a strong brand of nationalism, often a degree of irredentism or political insurgency. If you go back to Italy, they felt they were hard done by within the geopolitical status quo, and therefore a key element was, we will bring Italy back to where it belongs. So that's a dangerous thing. But the second thing is, usually they get, this is how regimes start, not end up. The idea that Putin can try and reinvent himself as this sort of broad-based sort of structure, I find that very unlikely. I think it definitely is a desperate grabbing at straws.
He's trying to hit the reset button.
Yeah.
Do you think he was in any way successful this week?
Well, we'll wait and see. Obviously they choreographed this, and presumably they regarded it as a success.
Yeah.
In some ways, almost as there is an inverse proportion to how far Putin and his cronies will regard it as a success, and the rest of the world regards it as an aesthetic triumph. to us, it looks ridiculous. I'm sure they're happy with what they got, the sound bites of, is it even worth asking who we want as leader and all that sort of stuff. We wait and see. It's interesting the fact that Jürgen's
I do want to talk about Jürgen's a little bit.
So, but the point is, we have to wait and see whether or not this is actually, and I think it's unlikely, intended as a real structure. It's really just at the moment a cheering cabal.
Well, it's getting its own bureaucracy, and that was one of the key. I thought the most important, actually concrete developments of this week with regard to the Popular Front is it is getting its own bureaucracy in every Russian region.
But is that a transmission belt for Moscow? Or is it something that will allow different perspectives to
actually
affect?
Of course, it's a transmission belt from Moscow.
That's the thing. So what? United Russia has its own bureaucracy. All these things have had their bureaucracies. The Komsomol had its own bureaucracy. I think the point is, if these are just administrators, of course it's going to happen, because if the Kremlin wants something to happen, then it happens, because resources and money get poured into it. The point is whether it actually has any traction with the people who are just simply thinking, this is the current incarnation of the party of power. Can it in the longer term reach out? I don't think so.
Right. Sean, what do you think?
What interests me, actually, a couple of things. But first off is that both of these movements, if you want to call them the Popular Front and the opposition, claim to represent the Russian people, right? So here out on Russia Day, they're representing the Russian people. But in reality, they don't represent Russian people at all. The opposition represents, for all intents and purposes, themselves. And the Popular Front represents, Putin. And in this sense, both of them share one thing, and that is they're mostly virtual movements. The opposition, by all intents and purposes, exists on the internet, outside of the coordinating council, and outside of periodic manifestations on the street. And I do agree, it's important that they keep surviving. Like, having 10,000 people come out, I think, is quite a victory for them, considering there's not a lot to rally them around. Perhaps, as Mark suggests, the Navalny trial provided a bit of energy, but perhaps even the Moscow elections provided a bit of purpose and energy for people to come out. The All-Russian Popular Front, this is really a virtual movement, a virtual civil society of sorts that's supposed to create a link between, say, Putin and the people in the broadest sense. And here, I don't know if I would compare them to a corporatist movement, because at least in corporatist systems or Italian fascism, there were actually real movements. You can't really say that for this. And in a way, they kind of remind me a bit of the Tea Party, and that they're AstroTurf.
Right.
They exist because they have some kind of backing from some powerful figure or some larger force. What strikes me, I think I agree that the Popular Front is the far more interesting one. And one of the things that have been coming out in them getting a bureaucracy is, will they eventually evolve into a political party? And that would be an interesting development, because it could, A, provide a potential two-party system vis-a-vis United Russia. But it still remains a very strange system. Is it part of United Russia? Is it not? Is it separate?
Russia is part of it, if I understand properly.
The relationship between these two entities seem to be murky. I mean, the question is, does it exist within the party structure system, or does it exist outside of it? Does it provide a bulwark, a check against, say, United Russia as a political party? It's unclear what role this plays. But what I think the interesting comparison to make is that the United All Russian Front reminds me of Nashi. I think there's an interesting comparison here where, in 2005, a central virtual youth movement was created to support Putin. And it seems that in a broader sense, in 2011, a virtual movement, social movement, was created to support Putin again. So in a way, there is an attempt to turn back the clock to a certain extent.
Kirill, you were, unlike the three of us, you were actually inside Russia when all this was going on. How did all this look from inside Russia, both the opposition and the Popular Front?
First of all, almost no one, even noticed both of the events, in the wider public.
Were you in Moscow or in Nizhny Novgorod?
Yeah, I was in Nizhny Novgorod, and there were no any signs of any interest in both events. And I was not, in the very center of so-called, natural people's life. I was surrounded this day with my old friends and former students that was not, so-called ordinary people. They were in the universities, and some of them, they're bureaucrats and so on. They never mentioned both the events. But if we return to our topic, I think it's both sides of this political process in Russia now. They play the same game, one game. Look, first of all, both parts of this game, or both players, Putin and authorities and opposition, they try to reconnect, as Sean and Mark told already, to reconnect themselves to so-called public, to the nation. It's very important. The reason of these attempts is a very grave distrust to the state and all the political institutions of the state and the party system. It's very interesting that even Putin and his circles and circle and his cronies and so on, they distrust and they disappointed in regular political system, including parties and governmental bodies and so on. I absolutely agree with you, Brian. They are trying to re-legitimize themselves with the help of so-called people. Of so-called nation. And it's very interesting that opposition is playing the same game. It seems that they try to be more popular than another side in this game. And both of them, they failed, absolutely failed, because public is not, as I told you, as it seems to me, isn't interested in all these events. And the third point of quick analysis is, it's a very narrow agenda of this so-called political life now in Russia. Just if we just count or just name several, slogans of opposition or several points which was discussed on this, National Popular Front event, it's all about, it's all about Putin. Putin is the only one part and the whole body of this agenda, political agenda. National or popular front is it's people who are supporting Putin, and opposition is who's, you know, opposing.
So one side can't live with him, and one side can't live without him.
Yes, yes, yes. It's very interesting, and in some sense there are it's a battle of two revenues who are, you know, one revenue is against Putin, one is for Putin, and public is absolutely now cold about this. I see the situation in, you know, in this from this point of view.
It's interesting. You say you were in Nizhny Novgorod and nobody seemed to be interested, and you were among people who would be expected to be politically active. Nobody was interested in these two events, which were essentially leading the Russian news that day. What was on people's minds?
First of all, that was holiday. Don't forget about this.
The Russia Day holiday.
A Russia Day. And it's interesting that I was walking, you know, across this main square. It's near Nizhny Novgorod Kremlin. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, such sort of very official and very, you know, boring official celebrations of this day with the so-called folk ensembles and pop groups and so on. And I was very interested in one thing. There were just a few people there on the square. No one is interested even in this, you know, the rather popular holiday with Dima Bilan on stage. So it's a sort of apathy. Mm. It's a sort of apathy, a total apathy, because everyone is interested in the economic situation. Everyone is speaking about the forthcoming economic crisis, which they are absolutely, all of them, all of people with which I was speaking these days in Russia, all of them, they are absolutely sure that economic crisis will happen in the end of this year. And that was the main thing which in which they were interested in. And not in politics. And that's why I speak about, I'm speaking about this very narrow agenda of, you know, of all this political process. Mm-hmm. It's not about economy. It's not about social life. It's not about, you know, reforms or even, you know, conservation of some institutions or some economic state. No, it's all about Putin, those who are supporting Putin, those who are against Putin, and it's a sort of political tautology, yeah?
Yeah, no, and it's amazing, having worked in Petersburg in the 90s when Putin can only be described as a minor bureaucrat. He was the deputy mayor of Petersburg when I was working there as a reporter. And to think that in 2013, if you told me back in 92, 93 when I was there, that this guy would be like the center of attention in Russia, that everybody is debating this one person, I would have told you you're nuts. But because he was an important figure locally, but God, to think he was going to be the very epicenter of all political debates in Russia would have been amazing to me at the time. Let's stick with the Popular Front for the time being. And Mark, I wanted to pick up on a wonderful phrase you used in an email to me this week that I am going to shamelessly steal on the blog, and I'm gonna attribute you, of course, because I always try to attribute. We seem to be moving from the era, you wrote, of Serkovian sock puppet parties into something else, into an era of mass mobilization. The wonderful alliteration of the Serkovian sock double alliteration, even Serkovian sock puppet parties, refers, of course, to all the fake parties that Vladislav Surkov created to create this kind of pseudo pluralism we watched through Putin's first stint in the Kremlin. If this is going away, or is this going away, what does this mean for institutions, basically? Because Russia's presumably still going to have a parliament. It's still going to have a government, regardless of what kind of window dressing you put around it and you call it the Popular Front or United Russia, with all these little satellite pseudo-opposition parties supposedly sort of kind of opposing them. What does this mean for Russian institutions if this is where the regime is taking things now?
Well, it's quite fascinating. I mean, I was very struck by what Kirill was saying about how people just don't care. One of the Kremlin's greatest strengths is precisely that politics has become something that is regarded as irrelevant, that they can be interested in, you know, obviously something as potentially dramatic as an economic crisis, And somehow that doesn't actually connect to politics. So, I mean, in some ways, I think this is... Surkov, as a wonk, tended to see the world as being populated by wonks who wanted to see political parties and political competitions and such like. And therefore, he sought to create a managed form of that. I think what the new Kremlin has realized, or is hoping to capitalize on, is that sense that, in fact, people don't care about that kind of thing. At suitable moments, they may well want spectacles. At suitable moments, they may well want dramas. But nonetheless, they don't necessarily want institutionalized political structures through which to work. So in some ways, I mean, I can't help but feel that the parliament is more likely to be like a reality show. Or one of the...
As if it wasn't before.
Yeah, well, you know, so you want to be a deputy. But its role will actually be... whatever role it has now, but increasingly less of a genuine political institution.
Even less.
Yeah, and just simply one that its job is there to just simply satisfy certain sort of basic needs. Again, going back to something that Kirill said a few weeks back, we should think about functions rather than anything. I think that the function of Parliament, the function of the structures of participatory democracy will just increasingly be to actually distract, divert, and in some ways discredit democracy as a whole. And this is why I think we come back to it, that my view is that the creative energies of this regime have been exhausted. And I think if you look at the Popular Front, it's a Frankenstein's monster that has been sort of galvanized into seeming life by the electricity of television. But as soon as the power is cut off, it'll just fall back into its component organs and parts.
Although I thought I heard you say something without saying it quite this way, that Volodya, you're saying the current Kremlin has realized that the people aren't interested in this. I translated that immediately in my brain into Volodin is more in touch with the popular mood than Surkov.
In that respect, and I am very, very sorry to diss your man, Surkov.
He's not my man. I'm just fascinated with him.
No, I think in that respect, I think it's true. Now, let's be honest, I think it also creates a very dangerous situation. I think Volodin is, you might say, in the 1 to 2 year span. Very shrewd at realizing that. The point is that it doesn't last forever, and particularly if, let's say, there is, who knows if there is, but if there is actually an economic crisis on the way, and I don't think I necessarily see it as happening before the end of the year, but nonetheless, if and when that does happen, that's a point when suddenly people are thinking, well, hang on, who is meant to be fixing this problem? Because that's really what people think about when they think about politics. They think about who fixes the problems that matter to us. And that's when I think actually this dismantling of all the structures of representative governance really will come back to bite Putin.
Another interesting thing, I'll go to you with this, Sean. I don't know if you saw the interview that Juergens gave to Deutsche TV. It was a fascinating interview, but the news broke this week that Juergens, who is, you know, Medvedev's brain, right, the head of the Insor think tank, the father of the whole Medvedev modernization drive, is going to be, well, he quickly jumped to say, I'm not joining the Popular Front, but it certainly looks like he's joining it to me. He's participating in one of its roundtables that's going to discuss, among other things, the Eurasian Union. But for all intents and purposes, he's coming into that structure. And he gave a fascinating interview on Deutsche last week in which he said that he made a couple of very telling comments. At one point, he said, Liebe ONF, leave Paris. either you go to the Popular Front or you go to Paris, and obviously referring to his friend Gurdjieff, who emigrated to Paris. But he also said that he felt that inside the structure of the Popular Front, he could hold down the liberal line. So the so-called patriotic nationalists won't have the whole field to themselves. And there's others like him. And he said he discussed this with Kudrin. I found this, I wanted to blog it and couldn't find the time this week. But I found this absolutely riveting. It gives you an idea how exciting my life is when I find things like this riveting. but I did find it riveting because I was like, What and this is going to get into some of the discussion we're going to have in the second half of the podcast about change from within and without. But Juergens is seeming to say that, all right, it's time for us liberals, and I do use that term loosely, to get into these structures that are being created by the Kremlin to try to influence them. Is that possible, do you think?
Well, it depends on if they're you know, you're speaking here about deinstitutionalization and institutionalization of politics. And it's clear that one of the things that will keep Putin alive in the short term is the continued deinstitutionalization of politics. But if Jurgen's in the liberal camp, liberals like him who are trying to work within liberals in quotes, want to work within the system, they're, if they take the Popular Front seriously, then it seems they want to actually establish institutions to somehow affect, right? So it seems that, you know, if more and more people like him take it seriously, this in a certain sense perhaps could backfire on Putin, right? Because the whole idea is that for the Popular Front is all of them to look up to Putin and give his praises and keep him at the center of Russian politics. But if you start carving out internal factions and institutions that are taken seriously and behave as if they are real and serious, then this could really possibly serve as a way to influence politics from within.
So Jurgens could reinstitutionalize the deinstitutionalized institutions of Russian politics.
I mean, this is what this seems to be along with his line in terms of what he was doing under Medvedev to actually, you know, have some real institutionalization of politics, to have Medvedev kind of be the crown of a more civic-minded, law-based form of politics. But at the same time, the problem is, again, as Kirill put, Putin is, as long as Putin remains the alpha and omega of Russian politics, nothing will change. And I think this is a place where the opposition could actually take a cue and perhaps change their rhetoric, because people are clearly interested in politics. As if they're interested in the economy, they're interested in politics, but it's small p politics. It's everyday social politics. It's not the big P within the Duma or even in the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. And the opposition would do well to start changing their rhetoric, because as I said in the past, the more they give Putin credence as the pinnacle of this political system and don't see everything under him, they won't find an effective way to actually change and reach out to the Russian public. As a whole.
Well, that's interesting that you put it that way, because in this interview with Jurgens, I'm trying to remember now, and but I don't remember the name Putin being mentioned very much when he's talking about what he wants to do inside the Popular Front. He was talking about things like, okay, let's take the Eurasian Union. Everybody looks at this kind of nationalistic, patriotic product that kind of sets Russia apart in opposition to the West. I see it as something to get our acts together in terms of how we trade with our neighbors and in a way to better cooperate with the West. He wasn't talking about Russia without Putin. But the substance of what he was saying certainly leads in a direction to the polar opposite of where Putin seems to be leading the country right now.
I mean, let me make a historical comparison. You know, the Soviet system had all of these social organizations. If you wanted to be participate, there were a whole bunch of avenues for a concerned citizen who's interested in small p politics to participate. And I know this best in the 1920s. The worst thing that could happen for the leadership is that people start taking these institutions seriously. I see this all the time in the 1920s with the Komsomol. When young communists took the Komsomol seriously and took the rhetoric seriously, this became a problem because they participated in excess than the regime wanted them to. Mm. They took things into directions that they saw as dangerous, and in some cases they actually were in terms of violence. But nonetheless, this is for an authoritarian structure that is based on a variety of different social forces and institutions. The last thing you want people to do is to think that these aren't just shells. And perhaps this is Jurgen's kind of long-term thinking. I mean, I give him credit for this. So not seeing – everybody looks at Russian politics within Russia – who's participating in Russian politics in the short term. And what's really lacking, as we've said repeatedly on this podcast, is a long-term vision. And at least Jurgen's is actually thinking in those terms.
Yeah, no, he came across – anybody who hasn't watched that interview, I'd highly recommend it. I think I tweeted it last week, if I'm not mistaken. Kirill, what do you think of Jurgens' little game here? Because it does get, as Sean points out, gets to the heart of a lot of what's going on right now.
Partly I agree with Sean, but on the other hand, I think that Jurgens' move or gesture is a little bit outdated. That was a long practice to try to influence the authorities or the regime inside, from inside. Yes, several prominent Russians took part in, you know, United Russia. Even do you remember about this liberal wing?
Yes, I remember.
Of United Russia. But I think there are just 3-4 people in the world who remember this liberal wing.
So, and they're all on this podcast.
Yes, and that is the result of the activity, by the way. I think this move or this gesture by Jurgens was actually was outdated, because now we are observing an absolutely different period of Russian politics, even from the point of view of political technology. The period of Surkov's reign inside, you know, this political or into in the political corridors of Kremlin and so on, was in some sense it was sophisticated. Surkov believed in sophisticated things, and that's true. I think you agree with
that. Yes, I do. Sometimes too sophisticated for his own good, I would add.
Yes, yes, sometimes. But he loved this, and he actually he believed in this, and that's why he invented all these political fake political parties and all these intrigues and so on, because he tried to establish a very, you know, complicated balance.
Like a teenager playing Dungeons and Dragons in his basement, maybe.
Yes, yes, yes. In some sense, it was childish, yes, behavior. But anyway, what, and on the other hand, an opposition was, at the same time, opposition was rather sophisticated too. Remember, just remember their slogans or their, you know, even intentions in 2007, 2008. They discussed the economical programs. They discussed, you know, the forthcoming, you know, plans and so on. They tried to think conceptually. And what do we see now? Now we see the period of you know, say, final simplicity or and even, you know, primitivism in Russian politics. Volodin, he's a guru of this new primitive
a guru of simplicity
period of Russian politics. But it's very interesting that opposition plays the same game. Mm. Opposition slogans now are very primitive, very simple. Putin, thief. Putin, you know, is this and this and this and that, but there are no anything what they which
although they've been pretty clever. I mean, I'll never forget you want a third time but we have a headache, or some of the ones that were out there this week, Ludmila bez Putina, Russia bez Putina. There were some pretty clever slogans out there.
Yes, they try, you know, this
the Russian language is rich this way to play dual play.
Yes, yes, yes. they try to play with official Russian language. Yes, and that is the essence of these jokes, but this is a very, you know, they're not very funny. Yeah, they're not. They're quite sore, and it's they're a little bit wary. I think
they're getting stale, I guess, is what.
Yes, stale, maybe in some sense. And all this process is the result of one thing that I think already happened in Russian politics: democracy and democratic institutions. I agree with you, Brian. They are already discredited in this country. And that's why the political games are so simple and so primitive. Mm-hmm.
Mark, your thoughts on Jurgen's move and Kirill's comments?
Well, I mean, Jurgens is clearly thinking that exactly he can represent a sort of a slow, technocratic, liberal force within a governing structure. Well, we've seen that before. Kudrin. Mm-hmm. That was what Kudrin did, and Kudrin did so on a far, far stronger basis. And we can see how dramatically successful he's been. I think the thing is that, yes, of course, Jurgens doesn't want to feel he has to flee to Paris. Then again, as I recall, I think he's the honorary consul of Monaco in Moscow. So presumably he can find another agreeable bolt hole if need be. But the main thing is, I mean, he's doing the classic technocrat's internal compromise. He doesn't want, I mean, he's already acknowledged elsewhere and at other times, essentially, that the political system needs dramatic change, change that's not going to happen from the Kremlin. On the other hand, he doesn't want to pick a fight. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he's carved out a small area that, frankly, has no grand political significance at all. You know, no one's been thinking, well, you know, what all, you know, let's face it, it's Eurasian economic integration that is the key thing.
But that's just a beachhead.
Yeah, whether it's a beachhead or whether it's actually a safe location in which he can do useful things, but do so in a way that isn't actually going to end up picking a fight with big bad beasts in the Kremlin, I don't know. But I just think ultimately he is kidding himself if he thinks that the Popular Front will represent any kind of a favourable environment for that, for two reasons. One is, I don't believe it's going to be allowed to have that kind of autonomy. And secondly, I don't think it's going to last long enough.
Mm. Well, I want to shift to the opposition now a little bit and discuss something that's going to segue nicely into the second section. And that's another thing that jumped out at me at the Russia Day demonstrations. And that was, this was very much Navalny's day. He was front and center in just very photogenic and telegenic shots with him and his wife. Very effective. The crowd, and I believe this is the first time I've heard Navalny's name chanted like this by a crowd. I could be wrong, but they were chanting Navalny Nash Mayor, Navalny Nash Mayor, Navalny is our mayor. And the contrast, again, these are the two biggest news stories of the day. And I don't want to say it elevated Navalny to Putin's level, because it didn't. That's an exaggeration. But this was very much Navalny's day. He took the day off from his trial in Kirov to come to Moscow and be the hero. He looked great. I mean, it just the optics were pretty amazing. Some of the photos I saw online and the television shots I saw were pretty good. Mark, was this Navalny's day?
Yes, and I think this is perhaps one of the most significant things that we're seeing coming out of the opposition side, is precisely that, particularly with Udaltsov in house arrest, other figures not having really sort of acquired the same stature, the Gudkovs and such like, that Navalny is emerging as the opposition leader that we've always sort of thought of him as, but that he hasn't actually really had. Now, if he can translate people power, and yes, great optics, to actual genuine authority within the movement, the ability to actually define an agenda and a direction and a policy, then that will matter a lot. Mm. Yeah, it's not going to mean that they're going to be taking the Kremlin any day soon, but nonetheless, it's going to take what has been this very, very sort of amorphous organization that
it
really
personifies
it. Yeah,
and it
personalizes it, but also it begins to actually give him some degree of, I hate to use the word, but power. Mm-hmm. Up to now, he's had considerable moral authority, but strikingly little actual power. Right. He might acquire that.
And just as I was coming into the studio, I stopped over at the news desk in our Russian service to check to see if Parnas, the Party of People's Freedom, did it finally formally endorse Navalny or make Navalny their official candidate for mayor of Moscow. There was no news to that effect yet as I was walking into the studio. By the time this podcast hits the interwebs, that may well have changed one way or the other. So we don't know about that. And talking about Navalny gives us a great way to segue into the second part of our program. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at one man who will not be running for mayor of Moscow, and another, I wonder who that is, who wants to but might not be allowed to. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London is Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Партия гражданская платформа не будет принимать участие.
Я на выборы иду. Я об этом уже заявил.
One is bold and the other timid. One is a consummate gadfly and constant irritant to the authorities. The other's an insider who appears to want reform, but appears unwilling to take chances in order to achieve it. Alexei Navalny and Mikhail Prokhorov were both in the news this week in ways that illustrated the promise and limitations of their respective forms of dissent. Navalny was front and center at Wednesday's opposition demonstrations as supporters chanted Navalny as our mayor. Prokhorov disappointed his supporters when he announced at a press conference Thursday that he will not seek Moscow's top job, seeking weeks of speculation that he would be the most viable challenger to incumbent Sergei Sobyanin. Sean, let's start this off with you. The way Navalny and Prokhorov have approached the Moscow mayoral elections offers an interesting contrast in styles in how to foster change. On one hand, we have the insider reformist Prokhorov, who was obviously intimidated out of running in what, especially with the potential support of Lushkov, could have been a formidable campaign. As Kevin Rothrock pointed out last week, Pozvanili, he probably got a call. And on the other side, we got the outsider firebrand Navalny, who probably will be flat out barred. Are both of these strategies non-starters?
As I said last week to this question, it depends on their goals, right? Yeah. I mean, for Prokhorov, the goal seems to be incredibly unclear. It sounds like he wants to play politics, but he doesn't want to get on the court, to use a sports metaphor.
I thought I banned those, but I'll permit it because Prokhorov owns a basketball team.
They're always useful. And he did say that they're going to campaign for the municipal Duma, so yeah. Perhaps they're going to, you know, go on this front, but it remains to be seen. I mean, according to a Forbes article, he didn't go for it because it wasn't sanctioned from above. The Vlast wants to have a round election. They don't want to go to a runoff round with Sobyanin. So not allowing Prokhorov to participate will most probably secure that first round win. Also, the goal for Navalny, right? It's clear from the optics of the protest, the rally, he is on the verge of trying to at least be a mayoral candidate, whether he gets registered or not. And the goal there, the question is, what is the goal? Is he playing to win? Well, he could play to win, but that's a far-fetched idea that he would actually win. According to some indications, he might be playing to at least force a second round. This might be the goal. And this puts the municipal Duma deputies in a very interesting position. There's a really good article on Slon by Vera Kichinova, who addressed this issue. Do municipal deputies want to give their support to Navalny, therefore to opposition, or do they want to keep their mandate and actually work within the structures of the Duma to deal with real problems in the city? And if you give your support to Navalny, you might lose the ability to affect or deal with the problems of the city. And if you deal with the problems, choose to not support Navalny, then you kind of move away from one of the clearest moments the opposition can make some – can rejuvenate itself to some extent. So I think it actually, the Navalny candidacy, I think, presents a lot of problems for those people who've been elected to the city Duma, and who do they put their weight behind?
Well, there's an interesting piece in the piece in Sloan was good, and there was a piece a little while back in Gazeta which looked at the whole concept of the municipal filter and did the math in terms of how many signatures you have to get from which Moscow dions. And basically, there's only room for one opposition candidate because of how the opposition or independent deputies are concentrated in the district councils. There's only room for one. And Prokhorov basically just cleared the way for presuming Navalny doesn't get convicted, and that's a big presumption, but presuming that he can possibly run, it cleared the way because with Prokhorov in the mix, it was going to be pretty hard for any other candidate just by the math of where, and not by any conspiracy, but just by the simple math of where different types of municipal deputies are located. So in that sense, the Prokhorov did Navalny a big favor and cleared the way for him. I will let you finish your point. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of make another point in that the opposition coalescing around one charismatic figure, right? On one level, they need that. They need one central figure to kind of represent them, especially one like Navalny, who's a very good politician. But at the same time, it shows somewhat of a skepticism or distrust of democratic structures, right? For a movement that pretends to be representing democracy, to put all of its eggs in one charismatic leader suggests that their coalition of, you know, the coordinating council and democratic forms of representation, they're a bit skeptical toward them. And I think this is the problem with putting Navalny as a mayoral candidate, and the one that And the problem that Kitchenova presents shows that struggle between, do we go through democratic institutions? That is, we've been elected to the municipal Duma and we can actually participate in real politics. Or do we go with the charismatic leader? And I think this is something that the opposition, if they're going to gain any inroads, are going to have to somehow reconcile. Mm.
I mean, I think that presumes, though, that they would lose their mandate simply by virtue of backing Navalny or signing on for Navalny in the filter phase of the administration.
Well, they won't lose their – it's not about losing their mandate. They'll lose – they'll be put into an opposition camp, right? It will tar them rhetorically that they are putting their support to somebody who's on the outside. And it potentially could – what I got from Kitchenova's article is it could isolate them as a way to effectively deal with city issues.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing with the Navalny candidacy that I find interesting, and that is that he may not even be playing to get to a second round. He might just be playing to get in the game. If Parnas, as is expected, nominates him as their candidate, his trial's still going on. And this puts that trial in a whole different light now. Because by convicting Navalny, that court is going to be essentially interfering in Moscow's local politics, essentially. And it's going to create almost an impossible situation because it's going to look like what it is, a political move to get Navalny out of the race. And if they acquit him, God, he goes into that race. He's not going to win it, but he goes into that race like the conquering hero who just, you know, beat these trumped up embezzlement charges. And now he's going to take on the thieves and the swindlers right in their own lair. Mark, what do you think?
Yes, I think it's this fascinating case that Navalny has this ability to take what seem to be negative situations and turn them into massive PR positives. Or one could put it another way and just simply shows it actually just how clumsy the Kremlin and particularly Bastrykin often are in their attempts to sort of deal with him. Because, yes, in his respect, it's win-win. We don't expect for a minute that he's actually going to win the elections, even no. if he's able to stand.
So even if he gets the most votes.
So from that point of view, then actually having an excuse, rather than just simply saying, well, we gave it a good shot, but because of all these various reasons, they didn't give us enough airtime and this, that and the other, we only got 24% or whatever the vote. That's slightly sad. However, if you can say, well, considering all the things that the Kremlin did to try and block us, we still got 24%. That's right. A glorious triumph. I mean, you know, he gives himself something that either way, whatever happens, he can spin this.
Yeah.
Now, okay, arguably he can only spin it to a relatively small constituency or range of people. But on the other hand, if he is in the race, he gets to talk to people that he hasn't really been able to talk to before now. I think that's one of the key things. Exactly. He doesn't expect or want to win, but by being in the race, he's part of conversations that aren't there before.
Right.
And I think it's also ones that he's actually ready for. I think, compared with some of the opposition figures, I'm not saying that he's going to pull out of his back pocket a detailed program for alternative construction routes through Moscow or whatever. Right. Though, on the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised. I think it's risky to rule him out. But nonetheless, the point is, he is, I think, someone who can talk about nuts and bolts, or put another way, bread and butter issues, as well as the high politics. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the fascinating things about the Moscow mayor's position. It is one that bridges those two worlds.
Yeah.
It is one that deals with really boring day-to-day stuff that is nonetheless incredibly important.
It's like being mayor in New York. In
yeah,
that
exactly.
Sense,
but on the other hand, you are playing on a national stage.
Yeah. Kirill?
I think the situation with the Moscow mayor elections is very complicated. On the one hand, I can agree with Mikhail Prokhorov when he declined the idea to take part in these elections. First of all, he is a very weak politician. Maybe he is a very good businessman. Maybe. I don't know. I am not an expert in these things. But he is a weak politician, and we can prove it with a lot of examples of his political past. He has just two very strong and powerful resources. One is financial, of course.
And the second is financial.
No, I can't agree with you. And the second one is symbolical and, human. It's his sister, Irina. she is a very good politician in some sense. She is a very good speaker. She is simple, at the same time very, you know, vocative and eloquent and so on. She can speak ordinary people with intelligence and whoever. And if you read, you know, a comments in Facebook or other, you know, networks about her interviews and speeches and so on, everyone, almost everyone, even those who disgust Mikhail Prokhorov, they, you know, adore her and so on. But Irina Prokhorova is not Mikhail Prokhorov. And when I was in Moscow several days ago, there were rumors that she will participate in the elections instead of his brother. Mm-hmm. And I am absolutely sure that she will be, she could be more successful in this case than Mikhail himself. But his decision not to participate in the elections is very wise. First of all, of course, he wants to be safe. Very wise from his point of view, of course. Secondly, it's a very hard work to be Moscow mayor. I agree with Mark. Of course, it's obvious. Yes, it's very hard work, and I can't imagine how much anyone who is Moscow mayor must work and think about a lot of things and so on. And that you gain almost nothing in political sense if you are Moscow mayor. Anyway, even if you are successful mayor. In this case, you can be, you know, a personal enemy of Vladimir Putin, because to be successful, even being, you know, official under Putin, it's a very dangerous thing.
But it puts you on the national stage. I mean, I wouldn't agree that you gain nothing politically. You're immediately a national politician if you're the Moscow mayor.
Yes, sure, but
in a lot of ways, after the president and prime minister, it's the biggest job in the country.
The question is if Mikhail Prokhorov wants to be national.
And this is the thing. Nobody quite can figure out what Mikhail Prokhorov wants, except maybe for the Nets to win the NBA.
And as for Navalny's decision to participate in the elections, my opinion could be a little bit, you know, exotic. But I think that this is a grave mistake. This is a grave mistake. If Navalny, he's, you know, very powerful leader of opposition and elegant at the same time and very witty and so on, if he wants to play, you know, this game vis-a-vis Putin, Navalny against Putin, he couldn't be Navalny against some Sabianin. It's, you know, it's not for such level. Yeah, he might.
If he's playing that game though, but as Mark and I both are just pointing out, he may just be just getting in the game is a victory. Just getting in the game and running against, and Sabianin is a Putin surrogate, if nothing else. So I mean, I'm not sure he's if I agree with you there. I think. Navalny's setting up, I think, a confrontation that is advantageous to him in an asymmetrical way.
I'm not sure if you, you know, remember Lord of the Rings.
Of course I do.
Yes.
You were with the hockey last time, and now you're with the fantasy novels. Okay.
Yes. Gandalf couldn't fight against ordinary orcs. He can fight only against Sauron, and that's all. That's all. Orcs, they are, you know, for hobbits and so on. But if Navalny wants to be, you know, a real Gandalf, he must be just, you know, it must be a final battle of, you know, of good against evil.
Mm.
And Mark, this battle is Navalny against...
Mark is shaking his head, so I'm going to let him take the mic.
I think it's clear that, see, Gandalf has to fight the Balrog before he can fight Sauron. In other words... Actually,
it's a very chtonic idea.
As Sean and I rub our heads.
Come on, I had to sit through
I'm
the sports metaphors.
I'm regretting mentioning Dungeons and Dragons, but go ahead.
No, but in the sense that, I mean, okay, there are limits to the explanatory capacity of Lord of the Rings, but I think we haven't quite reached them yet. No, I mean, in that respect, basically, Navalny needs to roll his sleeves up. Navalny needs to show that he's more than just a telegenic agitator on the internet. He needs to get involved in real politics. And in some respects, this is therefore the ideal situation, because he's not going to win. I mean, just as one could, and it would be an entertaining conspiracy theory to suggest, is that there is a Sobyanin-Prokhorov cabal behind Navalny to create an election and then sort of let him get on the ticket. Alas, I don't think it's true. But likewise, I mean, the point is that in many ways, the best thing for the Kremlin would be to have Navalny as mayor of Moscow. Have him deal with the damn metro. You know, have him get bogged down in day-to-day stuff. Now, again, I don't think that's going to happen. But this allows him to show himself as a real grown-up politician. This allows him to actually get involved and have a chance to then sort of say how he thinks he could make people's lives better, rather than just simply saying, oh, everything's Putin's fault, Putin's nasty, and there's lots of corruption, and we're against it. But to do so in an environment and a situation in which he doesn't have to worry about winning. So, I mean, from my point of view, in a way, although we're going in a sort of similar direction, I actually think that Kirill's approach is one that misses what Navalny is after, which is precisely profile and credibility.
Yeah. And whether or not we'll get to see this, Sean, last thought.
Yeah, I just want to note that, you know, in talking about all of this, I think what needs to be pointed out that this is all about Navalny. Right. I mean, this is the way we're speaking about it, and the way it could turn out is mostly about what Navalny's benefit, what Navalny could. The movement, I think, has a problem by putting all of its eggs around one person. Now, granted, they have no choice. Right. They do need to participate in this election. They do need to show that they can enter into real politics and be more proactive and not reactive. They need to make their politics more complex and appeal to people's everyday issues. This is absolutely necessary to go forward on a very real level. But at the same time, by putting all of their efforts around one person, they potentially could atrophy everything behind them. I mean, in terms of resources, right? Navalny's bid for the mayor, sure, it could boost his profile, show that he can participate in politics, but it could also create more disillusionment, right? Because people's hopes will essentially rise. And then at the end of the day, it will all, in the long term, all turn out to be potentially very little gain from all of that, a lot of spent resources. And they would have to rebuild themselves. I mean, this is the argument versus do they go for the mayor or do they concentrate on the municipal elections? The more I think about it, I think the municipal elections are a better way of allocating limited resources and to build institutionally with many potential politicians rather than putting all their resources behind one politician that everyone agrees he's not going to win anyways. Or we don't even know if he's going to make even in any inroads, let alone. So I think there's potential losses on both sides, but they're nonetheless in a position where they have to participate in some capacity.
And everything, of course, depends on what the Kremlin orders that court in the Leninsky District of the Kirov Municipal Court to do. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
It has been fun.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kontcheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.